Tonight's speaker, Dr. Robert Cook Deegan, is the director of the IGSP's Center for Genome Ethics, Law, and Policy. The center was created within the Institute for Genome Sciences and Policy in an effort to foster ethically responsible and socially beneficial uses of genome science, while addressing complex ethical, legal, social, and policy impacts of the genome revolution. Since receiving his bachelor's degree in chemistry from Harvard and his MD from the University of Colorado, Dr. Cook Deegan has spent much of his professional career advocating genomic research and attempting to bridge the gap between science and policy. Prior to coming to Duke, Dr. Cook Deegan was the director of the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation Health Policy Fellowship Program at the Institute of Medicine. He has also worked for the National Center for Human Genome Research, as well as served as acting executive director of the Biomedical Ethics Advisory Committee of the U.S. Congress. In addition to his work here in the U.S., Dr. Cook Deegan has served as a member of the Board of Directors, Physicians for Human Rights, with whom he participated in human rights missions to Turkey, Iraq, and Panama. He holds the byline for a number of scientific publications and is the author of The Gene Wars, Science, Politics, and the Human Genome, which tracks the early history and politics of a congressional study on genome research. At this time, please turn off all electronic devices and please hold any questions until the end of the presentation when there will be a question and answer session. Since we are taping this program and out of courtesy for those who are hearing impaired, please wait for a microphone to reach you before asking your question. Also, I would like to remind you about the Continuing the Conversation, which is an informal student-led discussion regarding this evening's subject. It will take place tomorrow afternoon at 4:30 in the Quarry. And now, please join me in welcoming Dr. Robert Cook Deegan.
So thank you, Hima. And thank you all for coming tonight on a dreary night outside. I hope it'll be a little bit brighter and shinier inside. I changed the title of my talk after some feedback from Jolie that suggested that maybe some of the students wanted a little bit broader than just a broader talk than just intellectual property, although I am going to cover the same topic that was covered in the proposal. And let me bring this up and make sure that we're ready to go. Have I done what I need to do? There we go. So the first and most important slide is this one. And I actually want to dwell on this slide a little bit more than I usually do in my talks, because for those of you who are students in the audience, I wanted to actually spend a little bit of time on career paths in science and policy and point out the real star of this is, of course, is my dog, Oshi, who does all the computer programming for our center. But here in this group of students, this is Phoebe Coe. She was an undergraduate, did some work with us, and she's now at Hopkins Medical School. Alessa Coliani was an undergraduate. She just left us last week, and she's taking a job in Washington, D.C. She was a finalist for the Rhodes Scholarship, and she is going into health policy consulting. This is Britt, and this is Stacy. They were PhD candidates in the English department who worked with us one summer. This is Matt DeCamp, who is an MD PhD. He got his PhD in philosophy last summer and will get his MD next month from Duke. And he'll be going up to the University of Michigan to pursue a career, he thinks, in public health and infectious disease. He did his PhD thesis on social justice and ideas about patenting and how it relates to social justice concerns in philosophy. Whitney is now working for Oxford University Press. Molly is aspiring to go back. She's doing a post-bac work, and she's going to go to medical school. This is Ilsa, who was our spectacular postdoc, had her MPP in public policy, and is now a resident in psychiatry at Harvard. Noah Perrin did an MPP and a master's in business administration with us and is now working at Telerik, which was bought up by another biotechnology firm, Genentech. And this is the associate director of our center, Lauren Dame, who has degrees in public health and law. And Deidre here did her make your own major in bioethics with us and is now working in Southwestern North Carolina. She's trying to get into Juilliard and a few other voice schools because she's an incredibly talented singer. And Suparna is now a law student at the University of Texas. So if you counted all that up, that's a lot of undergraduates. Alessa and Deidre and then Joe Four, who's not in this picture, are three undergraduates who worked with us and actually published articles in the peer-reviewed literature based on their research with us. And those of you who are undergraduates here, this is just to point out that, in fact, in many fields, including ours, in the sciences certainly, you can go ahead and do stuff at the undergraduate level that enables you to actually produce new knowledge that is rewarded by publication in the peer-reviewed literature. So, and here's just the list of all the folks who have produced some of the data that we'll be going over. So I'm obviously kind of proud of the students that have come through our center. But it's also illustrative of the number of disciplines and the way that we do our work. So this is a graph that comes out of, actually, I first came across it because it was in a report that was used by the World Bank in 1993. This was a landmark in those of us who teach about global health, this particular report, because it was a document that was orchestrated actually when Larry Summers was the head of the World Bank. He got very interested in using the tools of economics to improve global economic policy, and he hired some very talented economists, surrounded himself with some really smart people. One of them was Dean Jameson, who orchestrated the analysis that went into this particular report. The report was really important because it changed how global policymakers, people at the national government level and international organizations, began to think about health not just as something that you turn to when you've got enough money to think about things other than survival, but actually something that is necessary in order to enable economic development. So the thinking relating to this World Bank World Development Report has completely changed policies of the IMF, the World Bank, and many other places, thinking that, in fact, it's not something you do second. It's something you have to do from the ground up and from the very beginning, because an unhealthy population cannot sustain economic growth. So now, what's the evidence for it? This was one of the most important pieces of evidence for thinking about this. This is an incredible, there's a tremendous amount of data, but let me just go through it for you here. Along the x-axis here is basically money, how much income people have. So it's income, it's not wealth, but it's a proxy for that, it's income. And so what it shows you is that with a little bit of money, at every point in time where these measurements have been made, you get a lot of increase in health by the time you get to $5,000 per capita income. The other thing is that at different points in time, the asymptote of these curves, that is the maximum point that you can achieve, seems to be set by some sort of context. And it doesn't matter how rich you are. So here in 1900, it didn't matter how rich you were, you weren't going to attain too much more health than about 55 years average life expectancy. So why is that? Well, that's because the culture in which you live, the conditions in which you live, mean that you're exposed to infectious diseases and nasty things happening to you. The difference, and so what this, these are curves that are drawn about 30 years apart, and what they show is this incredible leap in life expectancy that happened during the last century. And if you look at the first two leaps, from 1900 to 1930, 1930 to 1960, most of the differences in those curves, and this is an incredible increase. If you think about it, for most of the 20th century, every week that went forward, there were between 3 and 4 days gained in life, excuse me, between 2 and 3 days in life expectancy gained every week. That's a bizarre figure, but that is true. That's what the numbers bear out. So that's an incredible change in the way that people think about living their lives, in the sense that it also means that if you have two kids, you expect both of them to live to adulthood. Whereas before 1900, that would not have been true. And the main difference for these first two jumps from 1900 to 30 and 30 to 60 was mainly increases in sanitation, transportation, general health conditions, had very little to do with medical technology. They had a lot to do with general increases in wealth and public health. And then starting about 1950, 1960, we do see these jumps, and most of those jumps after that, and it has continued to go up a little bit, although not to the same dramatic degree as we see in these curves here. Most of that can probably begin to be attributed to things like medical technologies that allow us to live longer, drugs, medical devices, better medical care. So medicine can begin to take credit for some of the increase in life expectancy about starting about mid-century, last century. The other thing to point out here is that it's really hard to get an increase in life expectancy once you're up at the top end. A lot more income doesn't get you much more life expectancy. If we go to the next slide, these are life expectancies as of about 4 years ago, 5 years ago. This is from the World Health Organization. And the really scary thing about this, given what I just showed you on the last slide, is if you look at the life expectancies of some countries, they're in the range that is actually below the asymptote that we showed on that 1900 curve on the last slide. So that tells you, if you think about it, and remember that curve, that a little bit of money buys you a lot of increase in life expectancy, it suggests that the countries in red have very low life expectancies, and in fact, in some of them, life expectancy has actually been dropping rather than increasing. So it means they're so poor that they're very, very, very low on that curve. And what's also interesting is places like Japan, Australia, North America, especially the Scandinavian countries, life expectancy has been continuing to go up into the 80s, even though it costs a whole lot of money to buy just a little bit of extra life expectancy. So for both of those things to be happening, life expectancy be going up in the rich countries and down in the poorest countries, suggests the disparities are actually getting worse over time. Now, what's that got to do with what I'm going to be talking about? Well, I don't want to make the mistake of attributing those changes to the system of patenting and intellectual property that we've got, but I don't think they are completely unrelated. And I'll explain a little bit more about some of the ways that I think they're related as I go along here. So that's just the general backdrop and putting what I'm going to be talking about into a global context that I'll come back to at the very end of the talk. I'm now going to shift gears, and I'm going to shift to the United States. And I'm going to be talking for the next few slides about health research in general. And then I'm going to shift gears and focus on health research that's related to the field that I study in more detail, genomics. This is an inflation-adjusted graph of the National Institutes of Health budget, the parts of the government that we now call the National Institutes of Health. Things have come and gone in the bureaucratic entity that we call NIH over the years. But this is an inflation-adjusted budget table, basically, that starts right here around the time of World War II and goes up through 2003, which was the end of the doubling of the NIH budget a few years ago. Huge increase, of course, in the number of real dollars, since it's inflation-adjusted, going into health research. And here is a graph of, this is a different, slightly different measure. This is called Budget Function 550, from the way that the federal government calculates budgets. These are the health research accounts. It includes the NIH, which is about 85% of this number, all across here. But the thing to point out on this slide is this even more rapidly escalating curve, this blue one, is the expenditures in the United States of the members of the Pharmaceutical Research and Manufacturing Association. That's the big companies, the large companies that do research-intensive pharmaceutical research. So it's like Merck, Pfizer. Pharma also includes Genentech and Amgen, but not most of the other biotechnology companies. The point is that, in fact, there's been this very dramatic increase in the federal funding, but sometime in the late 1980s, early 1990s, that was exceeded by the amount of private R&D going into health research in the United States from one sector, the pharmaceutical sector. And this is the final boring number graph that I'll show you related to the federal budget. This compares the major seven accounts in the U.S. federal government for different kinds of research. So this is the Department of Commerce. This is USDA, which is ag research. NSF is kind of the scientific flywheel. It does basic science, research, and education. This is only their research budget part. This is what we would now call the Department of Energy and its previous bureaucratic identifications. The National, NASA, you all know what that does. The Department of Defense, which comes and goes in popularity. And then this huge blue wedge in the back is what we would now call the National Institutes of Health. And the thing to notice about this is that at the beginning of this curve, health research, that is NIH and its related agencies, would have accounted for only about $1.04 in research in the United States. And now, at the end of this period, it accounts for about 60%, between 55 and 60% of all the research dollars in the United States go to the life sciences. Huge change in the proportion of the federal R&D budget that goes to the life sciences. So here's another take at those same numbers, and I wish I'd done this to scale, but I only want to point out two things about it. These are the numbers for health research in the United States in three points in time, 1940, so before World War II, the mid-60s, and then the late 1990s. And I only want to point out two things about this graph. One is you see the white thing here is industry. So this is mainly what we would think of now as pharmaceuticals. It kind of corresponds to that curve that I showed you before. The thing to notice is that really shrank from 1940 to 1965. And the reason that it shrank is because this is a pie chart. In fact, the amount of money actually went up in the white section from here to here. But what happened is the growth in federal funding, this kind of purplish wedge, spectacularly increased in the 1950s and into the 1960s. And I picked 1965 because it was kind of the peak of federal funding for life sciences. And since this point, what we've seen is the growth in the white wedge relative to the government wedge. And you also see that there's a recession, a decrease in the amount of funding that's coming from the philanthropic sector. So in the 1940s, the word molecular biology, the field that I came from, was coined in 1938. It was coined at the Rockefeller Foundation by a mathematician, Warren Weaver. And he was part of this philanthropic wedge. And it turned out that if you looked at the pioneering science that was going on in the 1950s and early 1960s, most of the best research was funded by the Carnegie Institution, Rockefeller Foundation, Guggenheim Foundation, or other private philanthropies. That kind of went away, and for example, the Rockefeller Foundation kind of pulled out of health research, precisely because the NIH was getting into it in such a big way, and they thought that their private dollars would be better leveraged by leading the Green Revolution and turning their attention to agricultural research instead of health research. And that was actually, again, it was Warren Weaver who came up with that strategy. So the philanthropic proportion has gone down, even though in the United States we have very large philanthropies like, this is kind of pre-Gates. The Gates Foundation hadn't gotten too active by the time this graph was done. But we do have things in there like the Howard Hughes Medical Institute and other private philanthropies. And then finally, this is the last slide I'm going to show of general health R&D. This shows a 1998 snapshot, the first time this was ever done. And what I took was the numbers that were taken from this report, the Global Forum for Health Research, and I normalized them to the GDP of a country. And what you notice here is something that's really, maybe it's not surprising to you, but the United States has the highest fraction of its R&D going to health research of any of the countries surveyed in 1998. And this was true again when they redid this survey for the numbers from 2001-2002. When they did it in 1998, the U.S. accounted for 57% of the world's total of health research. Now think about that. That's a huge number, since we're only one country. When they redid it, it dropped to 49%, and it's not because the numbers changed, it's because they discovered some budgets in other countries that they hadn't discovered before. But the U.S. remains top fraction of GDP, and of course we have by far the largest GDP. Now the fact is, if we did this for general R&D, this would not be true in the United States. If we did this, it would probably be true in computing research and a few other fields, but it would not be true for engineering, chemistry, physics, we'd be below the Germans and the Japanese and the Swedes. We'd be somewhere out there. We'd probably be out here with the Cubans or the Italians or something like that. So why am I going into this? The point is I'm just making a general contextual statement that in the post-war period, since World War II, life sciences, particularly in the United States, got to be really, really big. The opening wedge, the first movement there, was the federal government taking its responsibility to fund basic research in the life sciences quite seriously, a political dynamic that made it kind of pushed a virtuous circle of continuing political incentives to support life sciences research that led to relatively rapid growth of the NIH budget relative to other budgets. And that then, in my view, induced an investment in the private sector that to take advantage of the research that was emerging from the public sector to exploit it for developing drugs, biologics, vaccines, and medical devices, driven by the federally funded research that had taken place to lay the groundwork for exploitation of the basic research. So the point about the science is that, in fact, it was driven in large part by a federal investment, but then it spilled over into the private sector, joining forces and eventually exceeding the federal government's investment in health research. So that's point one. Point two is this is a domain of science that is somewhat different from cosmology or particle physics, in that most people can kind of understand how it touches their lives. Moreover, it's a domain of science that Donald Stokes has talked about breaking science into, instead of having this idea that at one end we have basic science and at the other end we have applied science and development, let's turn that axis so that you don't say that they're that being practical and being applied are not necessarily antithetical to one another. You rotate the axis so that it says understanding things can be on one axis and finding something that's practically useful is on another axis. And what you discover is that some research is purely understanding-driven, like cosmology, or maybe some kinds of anthropology, human origins, stuff like that. We don't expect a lot of really practical things to come from understanding how the primate ancestor gave rise to human beings, but it's kind of interesting and we want to know the answer, just because we find it interesting. On the other hand, you have inventions that are purely driven by technology and don't really inform us too much about how the world works, but we like the widgets. Don Stokes made this observation that there are, in fact, huge domains of science that are both highly practical and give us deep insights into how the natural world works. He called this Pasteur's quadrant because most of the work that Louis Pasteur did was driven by very pragmatic interests, but it was also, he was a cultural icon and a hero of the scientific world, still one of the most famous Frenchmen who ever lived. And he had all of these roles. He was both a clinician eventually. I mean, he actually was very famous for developing vaccines for rabies and for anthrax. He did a lot of research, obviously. He was also really entrepreneurial. He patented things for the brewing industry in France. A lot of the money that created the Pasteur Institute was developed by selling vaccines for livestock to prevent them from getting anthrax. He helped the beer industry and the wine industry in France. He was very clever about how he did that, and of course he was a really famous guy. Gerald Geisen did a very interesting book on him because he is this scientific hero that all of us laud and applaud, but it turns out he was also pretty secretive. And this is the point that I wanted to bring to the surface, that all along there has been a norm within science, this idea that there can be science that is secret, in part because of commercial motives, actually goes back all the way to the 1800s. This is not a completely new phenomenon, but it has been newly acknowledged in the context of the modern life sciences. So now I'm going to turn to academic science specifically and talk about a few things that seem to drive academic science in contrast to some other domains of science that we'll be talking about later. The biggest thing that an academic cares about is their reputation. You want to work at a famous university and have people think that you're cool. You want to go give talks at a place like Dickinson, right? And people will stand up and applaud you, and that's what drives us. That's what our big motivator is. We care a lot about getting attention and credit for what we do. We tend to measure it that way even more than by the money, although none of us ignore that. And the premium is on discovering something first, because we all know that that's the strategy for achieving these other two aims. So one of the things that has been changing is the field of genomics, and here I'm beginning to make a transition into genomics, is that it's a little bit harder to do that in a field that requires lots of whiz-bang technology that costs a lot of money, because usually you need people to run those machines, and you've got teams of 10. And if you look at the, I'll show you some papers later in the talk that have over 100 authors on them. So it's kind of hard to figure out how to distribute the credit in something like that, because it's beginning to look like high-energy physics, where, in fact, you broker credit in a very social networky kind of a way instead of just publishing it, and the world will know exactly who did what just by looking at the paper. And, of course, one of the other things about genomics is we never know when we're done with anything, because we never really are. I don't know how many times the reference sequence for the human genome is going to be complete. It's been at least 3 or 4 times so far. The first time was in June of 2000, which is really a political event. And then the first publications came out in February 2001, and then there was a succession of one chromosome at a time publications through 2003. But the fact is we still have whole expanses of the human genome that haven't been sequenced. And it's going to take a good long while before we're done with that. We may never be done with it. So for those of you entering the field of genomics, if any of you are interested in doing it, here are some questions that if I were a student I would want to be asking as I walk into the lab, and I won't dwell on that, but these are a series of questions that I think will set the context for some of the things I'm going to mention in the rest of the talk. One thing to notice is if you're an undergraduate, remember that the people that are teaching you, for the most part, trained at that period when the pie chart was primarily federal. So the norms that we think of as being the natural way that the world is as we inherited it has changed rather dramatically, and the folks that are a generation ahead of you are living in a world that's different from the one that you're going to inhabit. So they were used to molecular biology as a cottage industry. They were used to biology that was driven by hypothesis and experiment as opposed to data and instrumentation. And most of us grew up in a world where all of us expected that even though we were one of maybe 6 or 7 grad students in a lab, every one of us as grad students or postdocs expected to run our own lab that would have 6 or 7 grad students in it. Now, you do the math. How long can you do that? The only time you can do that is when you're on an exponential growth curve. And in fact, we were. You saw the graph. We were on an exponential growth curve into the 1980s, 1990s, but that actually stopped, and it really stopped 5 years ago. In the life sciences in the United States, the budgets have been pretty flat for the last 5 years, and the system has not accommodated that. And so this world of everybody expecting to run their own lab, actually the only realistic expectation now is if you're a postdoc, unless you're the only postdoc in the lab, you shouldn't expect to run your own lab, because it just can't work out that way. There's not enough money to fuel the system. And everybody was expecting the NIH to carry the whole system, and that it would continue to grow exponentially in order to enable all this growth of biomedical research. So the bottom line is it's really a good idea to listen to your mentors. I don't want to tell you otherwise, but also eat it with a grain of salt. So now I'm going to tell two stories, and I'm going to tell a story about different ways of doing science that has more or less the same end result as the goal. And what I'm looking at here, what you're looking at here, is the two papers. This is the result of the so-called Public Genome Project. This is the draft reference genome publication that came out in February of 2001. Nature publishes on Thursdays, Science publishes on Fridays, or the other way around, I can't remember which. I always reference them online, I can't even remember which one comes out with day. So these journal issues came out one day apart, and this was the genome publication that was primarily generated by Celera Genomics, a private company, and this was the one that was put together by an aggregate of labs from all over the world, primarily in the US, Europe, Japan, and China. And I'm going to be telling two different stories about the style of doing genomics that are embodied in those publications. One is the Mertonian science, and here I'm not talking about Merton the theologian. I'm talking about Merton, the guy who used to study how science works, who wrote a book about the norms of skepticism, openness, and cultivated skepticism about new data that depended on people sharing their data and being able to replicate one another's experiments in an open system. So it's a peon to open science. And most scientists, particularly those who grew up when federal funding was the dominant source of funding, believe in this style of science. And it's embodied most strongly in the genome community by the folks who used to study nematode worms. This became the kind of the sociological model for the right way to do genome research because of history and various pathways. And they were contending with a private approach to doing the genome that was embodied by Celera and some other companies that I'll talk about in just a minute. The kind of demigod of the public genome movement, this is John Sulston. This is the Sanger Center, or what's now the Sanger Institute at the University of Cambridge. And he's actually sitting under this tree. I don't think it's probably the exact same tree that dropped the apple that hit Isaac Newton on the head, but it could have been. And that's certainly why he's sitting that way, is to be reminiscent of that. And he was the champion of this open source way, I'm calling it open source, this open framework for doing science that said, you know, we're willing to take your money and we're going to spend a lot of money on sequencing machines and databases and computer scientists and the really hard slog of highly technological science. And we're going to collect those data and do that work at a centralized facility, but then we're going to share it with the world. And we're going to share it every day. Every time we have a sequence of more than 1,000 base pairs, we're going to publish it on the web every 24 hours. So we're going to pump the information out as quickly as possible so as many eyes can see it as possible. And we see our source, our job as scientists is to create the information that many, many, many people can use. That's a stark contrast with the other approach that began to take form in 1998 with the formation of what was eventually called Celera. And there are two books about this story. One is by James Shreve called The Genome War, and the other is Craig Venter's autobiography that just came out a few months ago. And incidentally, you can get it for about $5. It's now on remainder at Amazon, because I think the paperback's about to come out. So this is a guy who became a cultural icon. People in the genomics business like to call him Darth Venter, because he was kind of the embodiment of the other way of doing science, the dark side of science, that is, keep it secret. But in fact, that's not actually fair. Because in fact, what they had to do was share their data by subscription if their business model was going to work. So this is actually intermediate to the third way of doing genome science, which really was a much more closed system of science, that's embodied most flamboyantly by these two companies, Insight and Human Genome Sciences. This is Bill Hazeltine, who at the time was the CEO of Human Genome Sciences. He's ringing the bell to start the NASDAQ trade day, the stock exchange, that tradition that they have. They get a celebrity who's famous in business to start the stock exchange each day. And guess what? Here's where we have our first mention of patents on the human genome. So what were these companies doing? These companies began to sequence the juicy bits of the human genome. They were using the same techniques that the labs doing sequencing for other things were doing. They were using the same ABI machines, applied biosystems machines. What they were doing, though, before they started their sequencers, is they were selecting the parts of the genome that they thought were likely to code for proteins. And in particular, they were coding, they were trying to pick, and they were most systematic about this at Human Genome Sciences, they were trying to pick the parts of the genome that coded for proteins that were either clipped off and sent outside the cell, which suggests they are sending signals to other cells, so there are things like hormones or other things that might actually be therapeutic proteins. They might be things that would be used in cell-cell communication and would therefore be potentially valuable pharmaceuticals. Things like insulin would fit in that category. Or they were looking for things that stick through the membrane. And so you can look at a sequence motif and you say, hey, this is going through the membrane 7 times. That tells me it's stuck in the membrane and it's probably a receptor molecule. Or it's a molecule that allows ions to go from the outside of the cell to the inside of the cell. So those where it's transporting a molecule from the outside to the inside of the cell, transporter molecule. Those are really, really valuable proteins that are very likely to prove to be targets for pharmaceutical development. So their business model was, let's pick the juicy bits of the genome, sequence them, send them to the patent office, and either we're going to develop therapeutics ourselves, or we're going to have patent rights on the genes, and if anybody else wants to do anything with those genes to make, use, or sell the things that are made by that gene, they're going to have to come to us for permission to use it before they can do anything commercially with it. So it was a very clever strategy, and these companies were formed in, actually, Insight was already in business and turned to genomics in about 1991, 1992. Human Genome Sciences was started in 1993. And they were really focused on this sequence-first cDNA biology strategy. They were not alone. This is a count of genome companies, companies that we kind of kept track of in a database at Stanford when I was teaching undergraduates there. So all these data were collected by undergraduates. And it just shows the rise in the number of companies that said they were doing genomics or that other people said were doing genomics. And here are the funding figures. This is a snapshot of the year 2000. This is the Genome Project that we all know and love and talk about. This is the publicly funded one, which is the NIH Department of Energy and its foreign equivalents. But look at this. If you look at those genome firms that were started up, here's how much they were spending on R&D in the very same year. And if you add that to the large pharmaceutical firms that were spending about another $1 billion, the ratio of private dollars in genomics to public dollars is roughly 2 to 1. And this is up from a level that in the period 1992-1991 would have been very close to zero in the commercial sector. So over an 8-year period, there was this incredible infusion of funds. It mattered in the capital markets. This is the market capitalization of the largest of the genome firms that we kept in a database. And you see this incredible spike. This was the year that the genome was announced. It was June of this year, which is one of kind of when genome hype was at its highest level. And the company Celera was getting very close to the market capitalization of General Motors, even though it didn't sell a single product and hadn't really even achieved its technical objectives, which was crazy. I mean, it made no sense at all, but it was true. So there was this spike, and this was kind of the bubble bursting in the genomics. But the thing is, notice that if you look at the long-term trend, there is an increase in value over time. And here is how much those companies, the top 15 of those companies that make up most of that market capitalization, have actually spent on R&D. So even after the bubble burst here, they've continued to increase how much they spend in R&D at those firms. So that expenditure on R&D has continued, and it would still be continuing to go up since then. So why are they spending this money in R&D, and why are private sector organizations spending money on genomics? Well, one reason, only one reason, but one big reason, is they expect to get those patents. I'm going to do a 5-second introduction to what a patent is, and you can ask me questions if you want more details about it. There are different ways to think about patenting. The way that some people think about patents is they think of it as a right, because we call it a patent right. But there is a body of thought that says it is kind of a human right in the sense that if you've done something useful, you should deserve to get credit for doing that useful thing. It is clear, however, that most of, and if you push the button really hard on these theories of patenting that are based on a natural rights theory, it turns out that they turn into instrumental rights. And this is the quote from, anybody know what document this is from? It says, to promote the progress of science and useful arts by securing for limited times to authors and inventors the exclusive right to their respective writings and discoveries. So this is the patent right, this is the copyright and patent clause from the U.S. Constitution, Article 1. And basically this is part of a part of the U.S. Constitution that says, Congress, we are giving you the authority to create rights for inventors and for writers and people who have expressive works for copyright and patenting. And here that's very clearly an instrumental right in the sense that it's not a natural human right. It's basically saying this is something the government's going to do because we're all better off if they do it that than if they don't do that. It's an incentive to induce investment in innovating new things on the theory that if you reward people financially for doing that, then they will do it, and the way you reward them financially is by giving them a right to exclude others from making, using, or selling the thing that they've invented, so that they can charge a higher price for it. So there are three overlapping theories of what a patent does. One is this fairness thing. You've done something useful, we should pay you back. There's another one that is we want to set up an incentive to give people money to invent new things. And then there's one very specific problem that it has solved in the drug development business, which is you often discover something and you think it might be useful, but you're going to have to spend a ton of money to figure out if it's safe and effective at doing what you think it might be able to do. And you're going to have to do clinical trials. You're going to have to prove that it's safe and effective. You're going to have to get it approved by the FDA, and it's going to cost you many millions of dollars to do that. If you do that and you spend that money and you put your drug or your device on the market, and if you can't stop anybody else from making, using, or selling that very same thing, then nobody's ever going to do that because you're going to spend all that money, and then the second you've done that, somebody else is going to come in and market the very same thing, and they won't have spent all the money that you had to spend. You're going to go out of business, and they're going to make all the money. So the idea is government says, hey, this is not a good situation. Let's set up a system that if you do something inventive, we're going to give you the right to exclude those other people from doing that, and it solves this so-called free rider problem, what the economists call a free rider problem. And it's done that very effectively in the pharmaceutical business, some would say too effectively. Here are some numbers, this is as of July 2007. I can say this update is now, I checked it last week, and it's just shy of 48,000 patents have been issued in the United States for DNA inventions. And a DNA invention is one that says something about DNA in its claims. This is the part of the patent that specifies what the boundaries are of what you've discovered that's useful. Of those, a subclass is things that are based on DNA sequence. And it looks like the best count was done by a group at the University of Sussex at the Science Policy Research Unit. And their best count seems to be about 16,000 such patents have been issued someplace in the world. Interestingly, only 750 of those are in Europe and 500 in Japan, and almost all the rest are in the United States. I'll show you a graph about that in a minute. And if you're interested in genes, now none of us know what a gene is, frankly. But we kind of have this idea that a gene is something, and for this purpose it usually is a piece of DNA that encodes the production of a protein or something whose function we really understand, like a ribosomal RNA. So it looks like roughly, depending on how you count it, and there's a lot of slop in these figures, but something on the order of 3,000 genes have been patented in the United States. That doesn't mean that the whole gene's been patented. It means somebody has mentioned something about a human gene in their patent claims. And they've said something about the sequence. This is a graph of the DNA patents, so that big number that I told you about at the beginning, the 48,000. This is the graph of those numbers through 2007. And, this is actually, the last number here is actually 2006, and 2007 would be right next to it right here. I should have put that on the graph, but I didn't. The thing to notice here is it didn't really happen until the 1990s. We went exponential for a while, but interestingly, for 5 years in a row, it went down. I'll get into maybe some theories about why that is if any of you are interested. But the surprising thing is it started going back up 2 years ago. And for 2 years in a row, it's been back up where it was before. Who owns these patents? Now, I've talked about all the business interests that are interested in the human genome. But look at number one and number two here. Can anybody read the top there? It's University of California. This is the largest state university system, and if you add up all 9 campuses, now 10 campuses of the University of California, it's the largest university system in the United States and the largest recipient of federal funds for health research. Number two here, if anybody can read it, that's U.S. government. Why is that? Well, 10% of the NIH budget goes to the intramural research program. That's a government lab operated on NIH premises in Bethesda and in our neighborhood in North Carolina, and there's one out in Idaho. These are government labs owned and operated by the National Institutes of Health, so if you discover something that's patentable at one of those places, NIH owns the patent. And that's why they're number two. And then the rest of these, number three is GlaxoSmithKline, big pharmaceutical firm. Aventis, another one. And then you get to Insight Genomics, which is one of these genomic startups that I talked about. And then Genentech. A first-generation biotech firm established in 1976 that went big into a lot of its early money came from the insulin tissue plasminogen activator growth hormone and a lot of therapeutic proteins that were developed using the new biotechnologies in the 1980s. So look, that's 5 categories. The top 7 contain 5 different categories of patent owners: federal government, university, baby biotech that is a genomic startup, biotech that's well established since the early 1980s, and major pharmaceutical firms. And if we wanted to, we could create one more category. We'd have to go down to, here's Hopkins, is the first of the private universities that's in the patent game. University of Texas, another public system. So, that's the distribution of patent ownership of DNA patents. This is a graph showing the differences that I alluded to earlier of a humongous social experiment that's going on in real time, whose significance none of us fully understand. And this is the number of the sequence patents that have been issued in the United States, the black curve, year by year, compared to Europe, which is the red graph, and the blue graph is Japan. So ignore the stuff that's out here because mainly what that's counting is things that haven't happened yet. It's called right censorship in any time series. So we don't actually know what the real numbers are out here. But if you add up the area under these curves, that gives you the 15,000 to 16,000 patents in the United States compared to 750 in Europe and in Japan. There are only 500 of them. And the other interesting thing, I'm not showing it here, is it actually takes longer also to get one of these patents in Europe than it does in the United States, and longer still to get it in Japan. So what are some of the stories behind these huge graphs of really aggregated data that aren't terribly meaningful? Well, here are some cases that you may actually have learned about or read about in the papers. Everybody knows about the breast cancer genes that were patented in 1994 and 1995. Myriad Genetics in the United States, in the United States only, has aggregated the patent rights to almost all genetic testing for these two forms of inherited susceptibility to breast and certain other cancers, like ovarian cancer and certain other cancers. If you go to a doctor and you want to get a genetic test for this in the United States, they will send the sample to Myriad Genetics, and they will do... If you're the first person in your family to get tested for it, they'll charge something on the order of $3,800, $4,000 to do the sequence of the entire gene, and they'll send you back the clinical testing result. There are patents for these same genes in Canada, Australia, New Zealand, and a few other countries. In those other countries, though, those patents are not being used the same way they're being used in the United States because nobody's honoring them. And in Canada, they have very valid patents, but the government of Ontario basically said, we refuse to honor them. And Myriad has never sued them. So what happens now in Canada is if you're getting breast cancer testing, most of the provinces are just doing it on their own. Some of them are sending it to the state of Ontario to do the testing so that if anybody ever gets sued, it will be Ontario, not them. But Myriad has so far not sued in Canada. So basically they have no patent rights in Canada, even though they have valid patents there. Another very famous case, a kid from this family actually came to my class this year. He's a freshman at Duke, and he had an older brother and an older sister, the Greenberg family. It's a very famous case. I'm not speaking out of school here. His older brother and sister both got Canavan's disease. His parents got a researcher to spend time and energy trying to hunt down the cause of Canavan's disease, which was not known. They found out that it was caused by the aspartoacylase gene and mutations in that gene that caused this disease called Canavan's disease. And without telling the family, they patented the gene and then started to license it in a relatively restrictive fashion. And the family and then the organizations with which the family was working actually sued Miami Children's Hospital, where this research had taken place, where they owned the patent. And they settled a case out of court. But it was a real, real nasty case that was on the front pages of all of the papers in Florida and many of the science journals for a couple of years. And this was a very famous case of a gene patent story that went awry. Athena Diagnostics is a company that does a lot of testing for Alzheimer's disease, neurologic diseases, kidney diseases, and endocrine diseases. And their business model is basically to take things that are discovered in universities, license them into their company to do the genetic testing. But usually when they do that, they ask for an exclusive license, meaning they are the only group that can do this genetic testing. So they've been doing this for all sorts of genetic conditions, and that's kind of what they've been doing for the last 10 years. And their business practices are now coming under scrutiny because the federal government is beginning to look at, well, what should our policies be in this area? And I can talk about that in greater detail if you're interested. So these are all cases that have caused controversy. Gene patent happens, controversy happens as a consequence, and it's linked directly to the fact that there is a patent. Here are some other cases that you may not have thought about as much. You may have heard of the Cohen-Boyer patent on recombinant DNA, or the Axel-Wiggler-Silverstein patents. These are both patents that were really important in the early history of biotechnology. Cohen-Boyer was recombinant DNA in general, and this patent was owned by Columbia University. It was basically a way to get eukaryotic cells to take up a gene and express a protein so that if you couldn't make it in a bacterium covered by Cohen-Boyer, you might be able to get a nucleated cell to produce a protein product in tissue culture using the Axel-Wiggler-Silverstein methodology. Mike Wiggler, at the time he had this idea, was actually a postdoc. And Richard Axel is the guy who won the Nobel Prize for his work on smell. Silverstein is a guy who works at Columbia in the health research part of Columbia. They were the three co-inventors of that technique. Here's the miracle technology that we're using in our labs at Duke quite a bit, Illumina. This was an invention made by an analytical chemist at Tufts University. It was patented by Tufts. It was licensed to this brand new startup that was built in order to exploit the commercial potential of this invention. It's used for all these purposes, but mainly what we're using it for is very rapid genotyping and multiple things. And then there are patents for all these other things, fluorescent sequencing, cell sorting. This is a very important Stanford patent. Pyro sequencing has several patents associated with it. What's interesting is on this side of the equation, they're in bright green, and these have been patents that have kind of happened and haven't, in general, caused a whole lot of controversy. There was discussion about Cohen-Boyer patent early on, but it wasn't really all that hotly controversial, as opposed to the gene patents that are over here on the left side. And the one that I want to really focus on is here. Here are some things like insulin growth hormone, clotting factors, immune modulators, and erythropoietin, growth factor for red blood cells, that have been patented. They turned into products. They were fought over in court in multi-million dollar lawsuits. But for the most part, the public hasn't been part of a big debate about whether this was a good idea or not. Why not? Well, because these gene patents have been pretty much in the same framework of something that we already accept when we say that pharmaceutical firms should be able to patent small molecules and then sell them for very high prices. It's kind of the same economic model that we've used for small molecule drugs. And all we're saying is, oh, well, DNA is the way to make a big protein. So we're just using the same conceptual framework for a different, slightly different technological platform. And you will see all three of those theories of patenting are exemplified in the examples on the previous slide. The idea that if you invent something valuable, you should be able to make money off of it. The idea there was polymerase chain reaction discovered at CETUS is in that category. Recombinant DNA and the AXL patents, those discoveries absolutely would have happened if there were no patent incentive. It's very clear from the stories. So the main role of the patent was that the universities that did that work got some money out of the deal. And they probably had almost no impact on the end product's price. I don't think the drugs that were made using recombinant DNA changed in price one iota because the royalties were going back to the University of California and Stanford rather than the manufacturers, because as soon as the patents expired, the prices did not drop. So there's a pretty good argument to be made. They didn't have much of an impact on price. Induced investment theory, the idea that one reason we have patents is because we want to create companies to exploit technologies. The BRCA genes, as I mentioned, they were discovered first by a company, although it was a very, very hotly fought race with a public sector competitors. And obviously, we've got these two companies that I pointed to earlier, and we've got Illumina. These are all cases of companies that got started because people were willing to invest because they thought they'd be able to make money, in part because they had patented technologies. So we do see company formation associated with patenting. And then the free rider problem that I talked about in connection with drug development is the same framework that we've used for things like erythropoietin and growth hormone. Erythropoietin is worth about, as of last year, was about $4 billion a year for Amgen. It's going to go down now because there's quite an effort now in clinical medicine to get a rein on the use of these growth factors for red blood cells. So this is a really, really ugly, complicated slide that you don't need to memorize except in the following sense. Look for yellow. These are things that were never patented and yet have been widely adopted in genomics. If you look at the red things like PCR and microarrays and some sequence method analyses, these are things that are patented in the private sector. And then we have a lot of things in blue that were patented in academic institutions, licensed to the public sector. But the common element on this slide that is that all of these things are incredibly useful, widely used, and some of them are patented and some of them aren't. So what can we conclude from this one slide? One, patents are not necessary. It is possible to have innovation without having patents. How do we know that? Because there are lots of things in yellow. There are no patents, and yet innovation happened. We can also say that things can be very widely adopted and found to be useful despite having patents. So it cannot be the fact that patents absolutely shut down science, because nobody's going to say polymerase chain reaction isn't useful and widely used. And yet it's patented. So that's actually a fairly powerful statement if you read the literature on DNA patenting, because most of the debate for years has been frozen in patents are evil, patents are good. And it's really that simplistic. This slide pretty much shows that that cannot be possibly the case. At a slightly higher level of detail, what I'm showing you here is the adoption curves for three really important technologies. And what I'm showing you here is publications on the y-axis. This is the number of publications the year after the initial publication. So this is the year that it's discovered, and we're going up through 20 years after each publication, each initial publication. And what you see is almost 1,200 publication citations to PCR about 4 years after it was, or 5 years after it was adopted, 6 or 7 years, whatever that number is. 1, 2, 3, 6 years after adoption, and then a fall off. And what we did here is we normalized these curves to both the x and the y axis, and just so we could compare them. PCR is patented. These two inventions, this is a very general sequencing method, and this is a vector that was very, very widely used, in fact, still used for cloning genes. And what it shows is there's not a huge difference. You can't say that there was any catastrophic impact, positive or negative, from having a patent on PCR. I'm not going to dwell on this slide, but these are all case studies that we are following of what is the role of intellectual property in having access to clinical genetic testing. These are all clinical conditions where genetic tests are useful. And what we've tried to do is pick out some natural experiments. They're the top two, breast versus colon and Tay-Sachs versus Canavans, are cases where in one case there's a patented gene, BRCA1 and BRCA2, or Canavans, and then another one where there is no one dominant patent. So in colon cancer there are patents, but no one player has been able to accumulate all that and become a monopolist the way that Myriad has for BRCA1 and BRCA2. And what we've discovered, actually, interestingly, in both of these cases, we haven't been able to see much of a price difference that's attributable to the fact that something is patented. It's kind of a surprising finding. And we can go into detail. And the rest of these, we're just looking at different ways of that things have been discovered and licensed. Some of them, this is a single gene, but many, many mutations. This is a single hereditary form of a disease that can be tested for that was patented, but is now available from many laboratories. And then these last three have multiple genes, and we're trying to look. Some of them are patented, some of them are unpatented, and we're trying to see if there's any correlation between their commercial status and their patenting status. And frankly, one of the surprising findings is it's hard to divine a strong impact that's purely attributable to the patenting of a gene. So it doesn't look like we can make any really, really strong conclusions that patenting either increases or decreases the likelihood of access, increases or diminishes access to clinical genetic testing. So I wanted to finish. This is my last slide. And I wanted to finish by having kind of paraded you through a lot of things that have to do with intellectual property and money and business models and all that. I wanted to loop back to the very first slide and bring it back to, so why are we doing this in the first place? And go back to why do we care about genomics and what are we trying to do with genomics? And I'm going to give you two examples. One's a really straightforward example of genetic testing. And this is the birth rate of newborns with beta thalassemia in the island of Sardinia. And what it shows is this is a projection of the number of people that would have suffered from this disease if the natural course of, if there were no genetic testing. And this is the curve of what actually happened, the number of births in Sardinia, once a genetic testing framework was put in place. And what you see is a very rapid drop-off in the number of cases of thalassemia discovered in the island of Sardinia. So here's a very practical, real people that don't have disease, or I shouldn't say it that way, a much lower prevalence of disease, because the way you deal with this is by preventing the birth of people who would have thalassemia, usually by detecting carriers and saying, gosh, you got to test. You either don't have kids at all, or if you have kids, you've got to have them genetically tested. You've got to have a prenatal genetic test before you have the kid. And if you have the kid, it's going to have thalassemia. Or if you don't, then you're going to have an abortion. This is a Catholic country. But this is what's happened in a real population faced with this health crisis. And thalassemia used to account for a very high fraction of health expenditures on this island. So this is one really obvious way that genetics can happen. And you can say, hey, yeah, okay, so we have a new technology, and this is what happens in the real world, is it changes the prevalence of a devastating disease. Another thing that's happening in the real world is we now have, this is the natural cycle of the parasite, the Plasmodium parasite that causes malaria. A really complicated, really, really complicated life cycle that involves human beings who get sick and die, And this is the commonest cause of death on the planet from an infectious disease. And an incredible health toll all over the world, particularly in the poorest parts of the world. It has a life cycle that involves a mosquito out here. Excuse me, this is the man part of it. And then here's the life cycle in the mosquito. So there are three organisms. There's the Plasmodium organism, there's the mosquito, and then there's the human. And here's the interesting thing, is we now have the genome sequences of all three of these organisms. We now have, therefore, the tools to be able to try to break apart the pathways that might be involved in the biology of the malaria parasite by studying the genes of all three of these organisms that we did not have before. It's not too hard to grow mosquitoes, although it is kind of hard to grow them in completely controlled conditions. It's very hard to grow the parasite, so having the genome sequences has made a huge difference in the pace of research on the Plasmodium organism itself. And it turns out that things like small interfering RNAs look like they matter in this disease. So the molecular biology of what's going on in this most common infectious disease that kills and maims human beings has actually been advanced by genomics of all three organisms. The hope is that we can actually do something about the organism. That is, we can actually stop the disease by understanding its biology. One of the concerns has been, well, is intellectual property going to get in the way? And I picked malaria in part because it was something that looked like it might actually be obstructed by intellectual property. The most common antigen involved in the man phase of this organism's life is a single molecule that is expressed on the bug, and you can raise antibodies against it. And at one time, somebody collected all the patents that had been issued on that one gene, and there were 46 of them. So if you think about it, and you wanted to actually produce something that would affect the biology of this, that would be one of your target proteins. And say, for example, you wanted to work on a vaccine. That would be a very promising candidate, but think about it. You'd have to negotiate with, there are 46 patents probably held by 30 different institutions. That's an awful lot of lawyer time and legal investigation that you'd have to do before you could even crank up your centrifuge and start studying it, let alone turn it into a practical vaccine that would be sold in the real world. So intellectual property looked like it might turn into something of an obstacle, but it's also a ray of hope. Because the groups that got interested in doing malaria biology, in part because of places like the Gates Foundation and the philanthropic funders, have actually begun to cooperate and try to share their properties, share their information, and share technologies and actually intellectual property is one of the things that, in fact, it's very unlikely that there are going to be huge markets and huge amounts of money made by curing malaria. So it's kind of irrational that we have all these patents. If you think about it, 46 patents on that one antigen means that probably something on the order of $10 million has been spent just buying the patents, just getting them, that probably would have been much better spent some other way, but people are doing it because they think maybe they're going to have to for somebody to turn this into a practical vaccine or whatever they were thinking of. So this is both, this is the target, this is one of the things that people are trying to work on, and synthetic biology is one of the things that has this in its crosshairs. The work that's going on at University of California, Berkeley, is focused very much on designing new bugs to produce a drug to counter the infection, that's the Plasmodium infection that causes malaria. And it's kind of a ray of hope for the new approaches to biology. A lot of that work is being done under philanthropic support that is, in fact, exerting very strong control on the sharing of information and intellectual property that says if something valuable is found, it needs to be very widely shared among all the groups that are going to be doing research on this organism. And the Gates Foundation can do that because it's paying for such a high fraction of the work. And the University of California at Berkeley has come up with a very creative licensing scheme that supports this way of doing biology in the new era. So I wanted to end with a ray of hope. This is a report that was done about the relevance of genomics to world health, so it's just me, not just me saying it. The World Health Organization has actually got a whole report that came out in 2002 on this topic. And with that, I'll open it up for questions. Thank you. Did I exhaust everybody?
Bob, the pie chart that you showed early on that had the percentage of the pie from pharmaceutical research,
right,
biotech, and from government funding, if you were to guess what that pie chart would look like 30 years from now, what's your best guess?
Well, what I was going to say at the very beginning of that question is, right now, I think one of the big things is the philanthropic stuff is beginning to make something of a comeback because of things like Buffett and Gates getting in. So this is a little deceptive. So I think there's a little bit of a growth in philanthropic money happening right now. Government for 5 years has been flat, and there has been increasing investment continuing in the private sector, but I think that's going to end. Because I don't think the pharma firms, in fact, this year, some of the big pharma firms are beginning to report that they may not spend as much next year as they did in the past on R&D, because they're really in trouble. And even though this is their lifeblood for future products, they're under such a financial squeeze that there's not as much money sloshing around in the gunnels that they can spend on R&D. So I think we're going to see an end to the rapid rise in industrial R&D. So 30 years out, boy, I think it's anybody's guess. The other thing that I would say is I don't think the federal curve is going to stop at its plateau for too much longer. Because I think health research is really popular politically, number one. And number two, what's beginning to happen is countries in Europe and Asia are getting really smart about investing in biotech as a matter of economic development policy. And I think the U.S. eventually is going to say, oops, we shouldn't have let ourselves begin to fall behind. Now, that argument happened in the early 1980s, and I think it's going to come back in about 5 or 6 years. So I think the federal contribution is going to start going back up again in a few years based on those two arguments. I had no idea I was that boring. I'm sorry. Yes?
So, So where do you think a lot of these patterns into the sequence are going to lead us? On the one hand, with knowing the human genome now, we have drugs that affect various kinase inhibitors, etc. So that's one aspect of smart drug design.
Right.
You know, on the other hand, you have monoclonal antibodies and such like. So where else, in your opinion, do you think we might be heading?
So the question, for those of you who couldn't hear it, despite the fact she was very good about using the microphone, where are all these patents going? So here's the thing. If you notice the numbers, there are 48,000 DNA-based patents, and only about 16,000 of those are accounted for by sequence-based patents. So what are the rest of them? Well, a lot of those are methods patents. Those are detection patents. Those are things like PCR, sequencing methods, analytical algorithms, whatever. That part of the patents, sometimes those are doing a lot of work. And if what you want to do is develop an instrument that costs a lot of money to make in a factory, and it's really complicated, you're likely to find patents useful for that process. So there are going to be a lot of patents that are going to be doing a lot of work in that area, like the Illumina patents. And so I think we're going to see a continuation of that kind of patent being very important. The sequence-based patents, the thing to notice about that is, well, another fact that I didn't put out, 48,000 patents. And a scholar at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, has just done a really thorough job. He's scoured, totally scoured, all of the databases of litigation in the United States from up through 2004, some I think it was about 1980 to 2004. And he's only found 31 cases of litigation over gene sequence, over DNA sequence patents. So way less than 1% of these have ever been litigated. And the BRCA cases account for 4 of those out of 31. And if you counted off the therapeutic proteins that were fought over in court, like tissue plasminogen activator and growth hormone and insulin, you get rid of almost all, that's 16 of them. So if you eliminate the high-profile gene diagnostic and therapeutic protein patents, you're down to a very small number of litigation cases. And yet, some of those patents are doing a lot of work. But the other thing to notice is this huge divide between the U.S. and Europe and Japan. So U.S. in one hand and Europe and Japan, lots of DNA sequence patents, not very many. And the thing to observe about that is of those 16,000 patents, they can't be doing very much work because they haven't been litigated. And I don't think anybody's going to say biotechs in Europe is starving or has been terribly impeded by not having patents. Nor do I think you can say that that has happened in the United States. I don't think you can say that having that many patents has done anything to hinder biotechnology in the United States. So it's probably, for the most part, wasted money. Right? And that's usually the story of patenting. It's a very skewed distribution. Patents matter a lot in a few cases. And that's the general story for every industry that you look at. So we concentrate all of our analytical firepower on those really unusual cases that do find their way into litigation for the most part. So where's it taking us? One other thing you can say about the story is it's the story may be different in the U.S. and Europe. And they may be different in the way the BRCA patents are. So I didn't cash that story out. The story of breast cancer testing in the United States is that it is dominated by a monopoly provider, Myriad, that has the main effect of the patent seems to be not on price, but on the fact that they do all of that testing for the whole United States. And that's how they make their money. And they're doing kind of okay. They made $145 million last year. And most of that is coming from their genetic testing. And their biggest genetic test by far is their breast cancer test. So is that a good story or is that a bad story? If you think that that's a fine way to deliver clinical services, then that's a good story. And the people in Utah love it. And most clinicians don't really complain all that much about it. There was a lot of frou-frou-all, and it was very controversial in science. But if you actually look at how many tests are being done and who's doing it, it doesn't look to me like it's a catastrophic bad outcome in the United States. On the other hand, in Europe and Canada and Australia and New Zealand, they're getting genetic tests for breast cancer susceptibility, and they don't have patents there. So I don't think you can make the argument that the patents are absolutely essential either. So I think it's a really hard story. I don't think either of the ideological poles have very much have very compelling arguments, frankly. It does suggest that patents can matter, because it mattered for Myriad big time. Believe me, Myriad believes in patents. Genentech and Amgen believe in patents, and so do the drug companies. So I don't want to send out the message that they don't matter at all, because clearly in certain cases they do. But I don't think it's a very simple story, and it's very product specific. Yes?
I kind of have a worry that right now there aren't cases where there's issues over access due to the patents, but a situation where I could see in 30 years, 40 years, if things like gene therapy become more successful, all of a sudden having these patents could be, you know, there'd be a lot more you could get with it, a lot more you could do, a lot more money you could make. So at present, I see this rush to get patents, and you're talking about how it seems like it's not really necessary, but it's also made companies stocking up where in the future, where there are other things to do with these patents, all of a sudden we've set these precedents where they have total access or total control over these genes, and I could see it's now stopping precedents in the future would cause a lot of problems. And I'm wondering, is there any discussion about that?
Yeah, so two things to say about that. One is, what about if you have a blocking patent or you have a lot of patents in a domain and they're interfering with the process of science. So some people would say that the Wharf patents on stem cell research have been an impediment to certain lines of research. Some of the genetic testing, it wasn't one of the cases that we've done, is long QT testing. This is a clinical syndrome that can be caused by defects in the molecules that allow ions inside to go into the heart muscle. And the clinical pattern is very hard to distinguish. But if you do a genetic test, the therapies are very different, whether it's a chloride channel or a potassium channel difference. And their treatments are almost opposite. So if you give the drug for potassium channel defect to the person with chloride channel, they may die. So you got to get the diagnosis right, or people do die. The genetic testing matters. And there is a controversy in that field, because this is one of the exclusively licensed patents to a firm. It's a small firm called Familion. It is controversial. There is a bit of a ruckus being kicked up about it, where people are saying this provider is not doing a good job of providing that service to everybody in the United States, and therefore maybe we should allow patents to be infringed in certain clinical situations. So situations like that can arise that are attributable to patents. So I'm not saying there are no problems. The other thing, though, is that it's not going to happen 20 years from now on gene therapy, because the first gene therapy, the really broad gene therapy patent, issued about 10 or 12 years ago, and it's going to expire in 8 years. And I don't think there are going to be very many gene therapy products on the market during that period. So that is a truth about patents, is they expire. And once they expire, they're in the public domain. So, yeah. I'm sorry? So for the old patents, the rules changed in 1995. Up until 1995, in the United States, you would get a patent for 17 years from the time that it issued. And then sometimes in a drug or a biologic patent, you can get an extension because of the time that it was under FDA review. There's a law that we passed that allows that. So it can be a little bit longer than that. Starting in 1995, the U.S. shifted to the same rules as the rest of the world, which is 20 years from the date that you file your patent application. So now you can kind of tell, starting in 1995, it's 20 years from the application date.
Well, why didn't they go with a pharmaceutical model where, in you get the patent for X number of years, 7 years, if you develop some particular pharmaceuticals based on that genetic activity, but then after that it's all over. I mean, to give people 20 years, it seems to me that you could simply file patent after patent after patent. It's like the guy who as soon as the internet came up, registered 10,000 names like Coca-Cola, Chevy, Ford, GM, and just waited for them, saying, well, come and talk to me when you want to have a website like this. Well, it seems to me that's kind of what they're doing, isn't it?
It's actually a complicated answer to that question. Yes, you can game the system, and companies do have incentives to game the system if they can. At the same time, the system has checks on how much gaming you can do, and they come up with bureaucratic rules about how long, how many patents you can have. You're not allowed to get a second patent on the same invention, in theory. So you actually have to have something that is new, non-obvious, and useful in order to get it. And so that's one of the rules. And you're not supposed to be able to get a patent unless you do. Now, does the patent office sometimes screw up? Yeah, of course it does. But there is a rule about that. And if they do screw up in that way and they sue somebody, then that person could say, well, no, that's not a valid patent, and here's why. Now, they're taking a huge risk, and they're going to have to spend a lot of money to take that risk, to take it to court. But they can win. It's a really complicated, but yes, games do happen. You patent the drug and then you patent a variant of that drug, or you patent the formulation of that drug, or you patent the method for administering that drug. Yes, you do all that stuff in the business. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. So, but it's a complicated answer. Yeah. So now you really are exhausted. Are we done? Thank you all very much.
on behalf of the Clark Forum, I would like to present you with this plaque and thank you for coming to Dickinson and speaking and sharing your insights with us. And thank you, everyone, for coming tonight. And we hope to that you come tomorrow to the Continuing the Conversation at 4:30 in the Quarry and you join us for future events. Thank you.